Well, again, it's my pleasure to be here with you. Some of you I know, some of you I don't, so let me just give you a little bit of a brief... Is there an echo, or do I just hear the echo right now? Just me? Okay. Of where I'm from. I'm originally from here in Sault Ste. Marie. I grew up at Bethel Bible Chapel, Riverside Bible Chapel, and spent 3 years in Thessalon at the Thessalon Bible Chapel. Since then, I've moved to Southern Ontario and lived down there for 3 years. I was married, and my wife and I moved to Los Angeles, California. And in Los Angeles now, I have three separate jobs, but that are all related. One is that I teach at Talbot School of Theology in the philosophy program. I teach a course on apologetics. So students who are working on their Master of Divinity or their Masters of Theology or New Testament Studies are required to take a course in apologetics, which is how to answer difficult questions and how to defend your faith well. So I teach part-time in that department, and I also teach part-time in the graduate school at Biola University in their apologetics master's program. And then I teach full-time at Southlands International Christian School, which is a school for students who are coming from mostly from China and some from South Korea, so that they can come to an American school, receive an American university. Their parents will send them here, and I teach those students their worldview course in the Bible department. So that's what I do sort of on a full and part-time basis. I am married. My wife, Nancy, would love to have been here, but she couldn't come this weekend because it's just too quick of a turnaround. I came in on Thursday night, and I fly out tomorrow afternoon, and we have a 5.5-month-old son, and it would have been too hard, I think, on all of us if we had tried to make that trip with him, not to mention all the people who would have had to probably endure him on the plane. So that's where I'm from. My heritage is here. My family attends the chapel. They've been in Florida for the last month, both of my parents. I told them that they knew long in advance that I was going to be here this weekend. They said, I know we've been in Florida for a month, but we're not planning on coming home until the 1st of December. And we're not coming home any sooner. So they're leaving to come home the day that I leave to go back to Los Angeles. The topic that we're going to look at this afternoon, briefly, in about 45 minutes, is the topic that Rachel raised earlier this morning, and that is, how do other worldviews answer questions that have to do with the human experience, that every worldview needs to answer? And the reason why I've chosen the topic of morality for us is really for three reasons. One is because it is something that we all experience, we can relate to, and we understand. You don't have to be a philosopher or a scientist to relate to the concept of morality. We all understand what we think is good and what we think is evil, and we all have opinions on those things. The second reason is because it has traditionally been one of the stronger arguments for the existence of God. And it's been a strong argument for a number of reasons, and one of those is just what I had mentioned. It's something that resonates with all of us. And when I say argument, I don't use that in a pejorative or in a conflict, to imply any type of conflict. I just mean that it's been one of the reasons that we've offered to people who are searching or people who are attacking as a reason for the existence of God, to sort of ground our belief, to show that it is rational and that we do have reasons for what we hold, that faith is not an irrational leap in the dark. Faith certainly requires a step beyond where the evidence leads and beyond where the reason will take you, but it is not without reason, and it is not without evidence. The third reason I wanted to address this particular topic and attach it to atheism is because within the last 5 years, there has arisen in North America a militant atheism, and that's not my term, that is Richard Dawkins' term. Richard Dawkins, we'll see later this afternoon, is the most prominent apologist or evangelist for atheism, and he is advocating not just that God does not exist, but that faith in God or faith in any type of religious paradigm or doctrine is itself irrational and dangerous. Since 9/11, there have been a number of outspoken non-theists or non-believers or openly antagonistic atheists who say enough is enough. It wasn't the secular humanists who flew planes into buildings on September 11th. It's not the atheists and the non-religious who are blowing themselves up in the Middle East. It's fanatical, fundamental, religious people, and it doesn't have to be just one kind. The belief inherently in a religion is itself irrational. So it doesn't matter what you ascribe to. Richard Dawkins has gone so far as to ascribe he would say that if you have raised your children in an environment to believe in God or a religion of any kind, that is a form of mental child abuse. Sam Harris, who wrote the book The End of Faith, is not talking about the end of his faith. He's talking about the end of faith, period. That people should relinquish their faith because faith is inherently irrational. Christopher Hitchens wrote the book God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And he is on every talk show that you can imagine. He's on every late night talk show. He's the editor of Vanity Fair magazine. He is from England. He's a journalist. He is brilliant and witty, and he is as caustic a personality as you can ever imagine. You can pick up Richard Dawkins' book, and I've mentioned him a couple times. He is the chair of the biology department at Oxford University, debated recently by John Lennox. Some of you may recognize his name. Dawkins has a worldwide bestseller called The God Delusion. And he starts off with this quote, "The God of the Old Testament is a homophobic, genocidal, tyrannical, etc., 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 that no one should ever believe in." So what I'd like to do this morning is say, how then does someone like perhaps Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, all of these are big names who are publishing books and are receiving wide acclaim for their arguments, provide an answer for one of the most common human experiences that we all share, and that's the existence of morality. And I'm going to propose to you that morality in an atheistic world is a bridge to nowhere. You cannot make the bridge from holding a framework of atheism and successfully build a bridge over to morality. It just will not work. So we need to define our terms to begin with. What do we mean when we talk about morality? And this is the most important part of our discussion. Everything will turn on this definition. And if we don't understand the definition correctly, we will not be able to respond, I don't think, to the argument that Dawkins raises, where he says, no, we can have morality in an atheistic worldview. Human beings have a universal belief in the concepts of good and bad. It doesn't matter where you go in the world. There has never been a culture that has been devoid of a belief in good and bad. We're not talking here about specific beliefs of what is good and what is bad. We have various opinions on that matter. But what we're talking about is that there is a universal experience, uniform across the world, and as far as we know across time, that people believe there are categories called good behavior, bad behavior. And furthermore, these beliefs don't describe how we behave. They tell us how we ought to behave. Morality is not descriptive. Morality is prescriptive. When you go to the doctor, he writes you a prescription. It tells you what you should do with your medication. It tells you when you should take it. It tells you how often you should take it. It is a prescription. Morality doesn't just describe how we behave. When we talk about morality, we're not talking about doing a survey and saying, do 51% of the people in the population behave in a certain way? Yes, apparently they do. Okay, therefore it must be moral. That's not what we're saying. We are saying that morality is prescriptive. It tells us how we ought to behave. We should do good things. There's an obligation that comes with morality, and we should not do bad things. We assume that this obligation to do the good and avoid the bad is not created by us, but is a feature of the world that we have discovered. I think that there are few of us in here who would make the argument that morality is something that as a group of people we have just chosen to say we should do good. Why? Because that's what we've agreed on. And perhaps there might be a culture out there who says you should do bad, And that's what they've agreed on. No, there are different opinions of what is good and bad across culture. But we don't think that the concept of morality is something that we have created or constructed. Rather, we think that we have discovered it. That there is something about the fabric of the universe that weighs down upon us and weighs down upon our humanness, which is universal, that tells us we ought to do good, we ought not to do bad. Consider the following statements. The last time the Toronto Maple Leafs won the Stanley Cup was in 1967. Apologetics is the study and the discipline of answering difficult questions. If you think that the problem of evil is a difficult question to answer, you should try responding to someone who's a Montreal Canadiens fan when they say, "And when do you think the Maple Leafs are ever going to win the Stanley Cup again?" That is a far more difficult question to answer than even the problem of meaning that we looked at last night. But the last time the Toronto Maple Leafs won the Stanley Cup was 1967. That is a historical fact. Did we create that fact by agreement? Did we all get together in Canada and say, "Well, let's just say that the Maple Leafs won the Cup in 67? No, that's a historical fact that is out there in the world that we have either discovered because some of us were actually there when it happened or because we've read about it in history books. Water is H2O, two hydrogen molecules, one oxygen molecule. Scientific fact, something we've discovered about the world. It's not something that we got together and said is true by consensus, but it is a fact of the world. The sun, at least according to the way that we view it, rises in the east and it sets in the west. Does not do so because we have agreed that it does. We have discovered that it does. The same for water freezing at 0 degrees. That helium is lighter than air. And that Sir John A. Macdonald was Canada's first prime minister. The above are not true because we say so. They are true because they correspond to the way the world is. They are objective facts. When I mean objective, I'm not meaning that we come to them with an objective and unbiased perspective. I'm saying that they exist objective, outside of us. We don't create them, we just discover them. Well, likewise with morality. So the claim, we ought to do good and we ought not to do the bad, is not true just because we say so. Any more than the Toronto Maple Leafs won the Stanley Cup in 1967 is true because we say so. No, we've discovered that about the world. We've also discovered that there seems to be this principle that weighs down upon us. We haven't created it, we have discovered it, that we ought to do the good and not the bad. And it's true because it reflects an objective feature about the world that we've discovered. In the same way that we've discovered that helium is lighter than air, it's analogical, that the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west, we have discovered that there is this principle that is outside of us, that we have not created, that we are obligated to follow, that weighs down upon us. So morality is an objective feature of our world. It doesn't depend on the attitude or the opinion of the speaker, and it's not determined or controlled by us, but it is recognized by us. We have different moral opinions. In the United States Constitution, it says that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That is a moral opinion. In India, over the last 100 years, that is not a self-evident belief for them because they hold to a caste system that you are born into the system that you are, and you are either, if you are an untouchable at the lowest end, then you are not a Brahmin in the priest class at the highest end. You are not clearly equal. Those are different moral opinions. But in India, they believe that you should do good and you should not do evil. And in the United States, they believe that you should do good and you should not do evil. The concept of morality is something that both cultures agree on, even though they have differing opinions as to what the good and the bad sometimes are. Now, if morality were not an objective feature of the world, here would be some of the consequences. Morality would simply become a matter of taste, kind of like picking a color or flavor or musical instrument. No one ever says, "Craig Delandria, what is your favorite color?" red. Well, is that immoral? Not immoral. Bruce, what's your favorite flavor of ice cream? Anyone else? Chocolate, tiger. Are either of these positions right or wrong?
Chocolate is right.
No, because it's simply just a matter of taste. It's not a moral issue. A particular musical instrument that you might like to play is a matter of taste. But what is not a matter of taste are some clear and obvious moral paradigms of goodness. Is it really a matter of taste for me to say that torturing children for fun is something that I think is good? No, we say, wait a minute, that's clearly different on a very intuitive level than saying that chocolate ice cream is good. One is in a moral category, one is not in a moral category. It's in a much more of a personal taste category. But if there is no objective true moral criterion or standard, then everything becomes a matter of taste. Everything becomes a matter of opinion. And torturing babies for fun is in the same category as chocolate ice cream is better than tiger. Tiger. We're left with no ability to condemn actions or beliefs, for example, such as the Nazis. If there is no objective standard out there that our actions either reflect or are warped perversions of, it's very difficult to say that any group of people has done something truly, objectively, morally wrong. During the Nuremberg War Trials, when a number of the SS were brought in and they defended themselves based on the argument that we were following the morality of our culture and our country, and we are a sovereign country, and you have no right to pass judgment on us. You have no right to judge us according to your morality. And the response by the United States prosecutor was this, that there is a higher law above the law of countries, and that they had violated it. But if there is no such objective standard, if it is something that we create, or it is something that is based on agreement by group consensus, then what is right and what is wrong depends on your group and your consensus. There certainly would be no moral progress. We can say things like, this is better or this is worse, because things are better or things are worse in relation to a paradigm or an exquisite example. We want to become better people. But when we say better, we need something to measure our progress against. So those of us who know the Lord say, he's the best person. And as I get closer to him, I become a better person. But if there's no standard out there by which you can judge your progress, then there is no progress whatsoever. There's just sort of change in either direction. If morality isn't something that truly exists and is really out there, that we don't create but that we discover, then people like Martin Luther King, Gandhi, who are social reformers, who have stood up and said, this culture is wrong, slavery is wrong, are really not saying anything other than this, I don't like slavery. I don't prefer it. It's not my taste. Because there is nothing to which they can appeal to greater than the culture with which they live. But we do know certain actions are truly wrong. Rape, child abuse, injustice, hatred, murder, torture, and racism are examples of objective moral facts. We know these to be wrong. We could be skeptics, we could be cynics, we could say, well, how do you really know these to be wrong? And we could run down a philosophical rabbit trail, or we could just say this, let's just be humans for a moment. Let's just be people. Do you really believe that murder and torture aren't objectively wrong? So here's the definition of morality that we'll go with. Morality is that feature of the world which is independent of humans, but which people recognize as a principle or a law that obligates them to do good and avoid bad. We aren't saying what good is yet. We aren't saying what bad is yet. There might be some paradigm examples, like it's bad to murder and torture. But this is not the argument. The argument is not cultures around the world have lots of agreement on morality, therefore there must be some creator. No, the argument is this. There is a moral principle that we all feel to do good and avoid bad. Where does that come from? What can account for that? Well, what is atheism? Atheism is the belief that God simply does not exist. According to Richard Dawkins, the belief that God does exist is a delusion. That you are actually deluded. You are believing in an illusion. And the caption says, there's no greater joy than soaring high on the wings of your dreams, except maybe the joy of watching a dreamer who has nowhere to land but in the ocean of his own reality. Well, this is what the new atheist movement is trying to do. They are trying to burst the bubble of faith and have all of us land in the ocean of reality that says, there really is no God. You need to give up your delusion because you are a dangerous people when you believe that God is calling you to do some of the things that have been done in the name of religion. So what can account for morality then? And the competing, in our culture primarily, the two competing sources are this, atheism and theism. The theistic world is going to say this, God is a personal, moral agent who created persons and the world. Morality is a feature of the world which reflects God's nature. And we are equipped by God to recognize it. There is a personal God who has created the world. This personal God is a moral agent. And the definition of morality will be God's very character. So the fact that we know that we should do good and we should not do evil is a result of the fact that we are created in the image and in the likeness of God. He is a moral being. That morality is a principle that he has built into this world. It weighs down on us, and he has equipped us to recognize it. The atheistic response would be this. Evolution, Darwinian evolution, it's important to have a grasp of what the argument is, and it's essentially this. At some point in the very distant past, millions of years ago, the inorganic, non-living material components of the earth at some point came together and sort of sprung to life. I don't mean to belittle this or make it sound silly, which is hard to do, but at some point you end up with a living cell. Once there's a living cell that has come about by this inorganic material, that cell can start to replicate and duplicate. And as it does, there will be mutations in the cell. So let's say that there are at least two cells here, two tiny cells, and they start duplicating. As this one duplicates and continues to produce more cells, the cells will have mutations. We're all familiar with mutations when chromosomes don't match up and they usually result in birth defects. Cells that have mutations that seem to be beneficial for survival will ensure that those cells continue to reproduce and pass on those mutations, where these cells over here who perhaps didn't have a beneficial mutation will die off. Because in the competition for food and survival, cells and organisms and species that are better equipped to survive will outlive the others that didn't evolve that way. So whatever is a beneficial mutation that helps you survive and pass on your genes will be selected by nature, in a sense, to ensure the survival of the fittest species. And that's the Darwinian account, the evolutionary account of how we've arrived. It's difficult for them to answer the question of how the inorganic molecules somehow came to life. No one is even in agreement on that or has proposed any reasonable theory about how that's supposed to work. But once they come alive, the theory says that you can account for everything that you see on the human or the animal world based on mutations of genes that have had beneficial adaptations
And so therefore, those are the ones that have survived. And congratulations, you are part of the species that have had the greatest beneficial mutations. You've adapted the best to your environment, and you are now at the top of the food chain. Well, our moral sense is a genetic mutation that has enabled us to survive. Darwinian evolution, according to the atheist, has to account for all of human experience. If we are moral people and we have a moral sense, it has to be accounted for by evolution. And so, our moral sense is a genetic mutation that has enabled us to survive. The fact that that those of us who have evolved into moral people are the ones who outlived perhaps a group of humanoids that weren't moral people is because this moral sense that we have has helped us to adapt and survive better. Well, if we're going to bridge the gap between atheism and morality, we have to have some plausible mechanism that shows how we have adapted this way. So this is what we're going to look at right here, and there's no better person to actually articulate this than Richard Dawkins himself. And I want you to listen carefully. This is from the CBC. I don't know who the gentleman is. Some of you will recognize him who is doing the interview, but he asks some excellent questions. And listen to what Richard Dawkins says is the reason you have moral urgings to help people outside of your own family.
Making it. If we are simply evolved apes, right?
Which we are.
Right.
Yeah.
And our behavior is determined by this natural selection. How do we explain those people who do good things for others, for total strangers, the charitable urge, the philanthropic urge? What Darwinian impulse would explain doing good for a total stranger?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I do devote a chapter or two to it. It's not that difficult for Darwinism to explain doing good not to total strangers, but to particular people, particular individuals, such as close relatives and other individuals whom you're likely to meet again and again throughout life, and therefore are in a position to reciprocate that good deed.
In other words, it helps your family,
that's
and
right.
Some self-benefit.
That's,
self-benefit.
Right. That's common throughout the animal kingdom and is well understood. The difficulty comes in explaining, as you say, why we're good to total strangers. I think probably the right Darwinian explanation is to say it's a sort of misfiring. And a very crude misfiring would be the misfiring towards a cuckoo, being good to a cuckoo by its foster parent. The foster parent is totally unrelated to the cuckoo, but it doesn't know that, so to speak. Natural selection has built into the cuckoo foster parent, the reed warbler, whatever it is, a mechanism which says, be nice to small squawking things in your nest, and that works. Don't shake your head, it's entirely plausible. That is what happens.
But when you say a misfiring,
yes.
So I am nice to a homeless person on the street, and you're suggesting that it's a misfiring of my Darwinian
yes.
impulse.
Yes, but that's not to demean it in any way.
Well, I'm glad that it doesn't demean it in any way to know that. What is his answer to why you are moral? Yeah, it is a Darwinian misfiring. Now, this is important to realize. The definition and the term morality has been radically altered here from what we talked about at the beginning. Richard Dawkins wants to say this. Here's why we're moral people according to evolution. If we're evolving, and the most important thing that I can do is to make sure that I pass on my genes, so I want to be able to reproduce. If I don't come around and punch you in the head, you probably won't punch me in the head, and I'll have a better chance of surviving. You heard him say this, that we do good evolution in an evolutionary paradigm because to those in our kinship group, our family group. Why is that, he says? It's because it is our family group of genes that we really want to pass on. And we have realized that if I do something nice for you and help you, You will probably do something nice for me, and I may see you again, probably in an hour or a day, depending on where we're living. And so it is better for my survival if I've had a gene mutation that tells me, don't be mean to these people because they might be mean back to you. Morality has gone from something that is outside of us, that is objective, that we discover, that weighs down upon us, now to something that is simply just a moral sense that has evolved within us that is ultimately based on selfishness. I don't do something to you because it benefits me in the end. Is that what we really consider morality to be when we think about morality? Or is that the exact opposite of morality? Are we good? Are we moral when we're being good to someone so that they do something good to us back? I don't think so. And then when he says, all right, but why are we good to people who can never help us out? That doesn't seem like it benefits us at all. And his answer is, it's some sort of Darwinian misfiring. That there's something inside of us that should only be nice to those of us, to those people who can actually help us and will benefit our survival, but something has gone wrong. And instead, now we're just nice to everybody. So the bridge from atheism to morality is a Darwinian misfiring. And that's why this is a bridge to nowhere. Because it doesn't actually ever get us true morality. Evolution, I don't think it's true, but if it is, it could account for a moral sense. It could account for a moral sense, but it cannot account for true objective morality that we've discovered that weighs down on us. If morality is an objective feature of our world, evolution has nothing to do with objective features of the world. Evolution has to do with us and our makeup and our biology. But it has nothing to do with the objective nature of the world. So when Richard Dawkins talks about a moral sense, he's talking about something subjective inside of us, but he's not talking about something objective outside of us that weighs down on us. He says this, according to atheism, evolution can account for a moral sense. He calls it an instinct or a lusting to do good. We have lots of lustings, he says. He compares it to the impulse for sexual intercourse. He says, well, we also have a lusting to do good. But this says nothing about whether it is really wrong to torture babies for fun. It just simply means that we have a subjective aversion to such behavior because it's evolved in us and it was beneficial for our survival. Let me just unpack that for a minute. Dawkins says that something is moral if it has helped us essentially, to survive. Treating people nicely helps me survive. That has built a sense of obligation, perhaps, in me, and so therefore I want to treat people nicely. But what happens if torturing babies for fun helped me survive? Would that be moral? Because morality, according to the evolutionary story, is something that has is a sense that has evolved in us. Not something that is outside of us that we recognize. And what does he mean when he talks about, and he didn't say this in the clip because I cut it off, but a lusting for good. What standard can we judge instincts by to call them good as opposed to calling them bad lustings? He's going to say that you have a good urge and instinct to help someone who's lying on the side of the road. But when you ask him, but wait a minute, why is that a good instinct? Aren't you appealing to something else, higher and more great and greater, to be able to determine what's a good instinct and what's a bad instinct? Because he wants to say that we have these instincts and these urges and these senses, but that's just simply something that's evolved in us. How do we determine which is a good evolving and a bad evolving unless there's something greater that judges both of those? So he says, we have this urging to do good, but I want to say to him, how are you even defining good if it's only the product of an evolutionary sense? The instinct to help an injured family member is considered a good instinct because it helped us to survive, but so did raping and pillaging. Why are they considered bad? You see, unless there's something out there greater that we can compare these instincts and urgings to, something that we recognize, it is very difficult to say for Dawkins why helping an injured family member is good, the good to do, but pillaging and hurting other people is bad, because according to his theory, both of those would help you survive and pass on your genes and would stop others from doing it, which is your goal as a being who's evolving. So Richard Dawkins presupposes a standard external to our moral sense by which to judge beneficial adaptions as moral or immoral. This is a quote by Greg Kokel, and I think he summarizes it very well. It's almost as if there are two categories of morality. There's nature's morality and a transcendent objective standard used to judge nature's morality. But where did this standard come from? It's precisely the higher moral law that needs explaining. If transcendent morality judges the morality that evolution is responsible for, then it can't itself be accounted for by evolution. Problem number three. Rachel touched a bit on this morning. Morality is prescriptive. It tells us what we ought to behave, but instincts and lustings only describe how, in fact, we do behave. C.S. Lewis uses the example of this. Morality is like sheet music, and instincts are the keys on the piano. The sheet music tells you which keys to play at a certain time. So, for example, if I find within myself I am in a situation where there are two conflicting, perhaps you want to call them instincts, that well up within me. Several years ago, I was in Waterloo. I was standing outside of a movie theater. There was a young man who was almost physically but verbally abusing his girlfriend. She was cowering up against the wall. He was screaming obscenities at her. He was out of control. He was on the verge of beating her. We pulled up in the car, and I said, "What do I do?" I have two competing instincts, my own survival and well-being that says, don't get involved in that. And the other instinct that wells up and says, you need to take care of and help out this person. Morality is the sheet music that tells me which key to play at that time. So therefore, the instincts themselves cannot be that moral law. We have instincts for sex, but morality tells us to say no to illicit affairs. Say that I ought to behave a certain way requires that there be a way that things should be. So, if I say to you, you ought not hurt someone. You ought not abuse someone. I'm assuming that there is a reason why you shouldn't do that. So, for example, if we're walking along the beach and there is a pile of garbage here and there's a pile of garbage here, and Amanda sees the one pile of garbage and she says, I'm going to take this pile of garbage home and I'm just going to put it up on my wall and it's going to be a beautiful art display. And I say, I'm going to pick up this other pile of garbage and I'm just going to throw it in the garbage because the wind and the weather and the water and the sticks have just all blown it together. It is just two random piles of really nothing. You don't even want to call it garbage. It's just perhaps debris of some kind. Can anyone say that either one of us has done something wrong with the pile of garbage? She's put it on the wall as a piece of art. I've thrown it away. No, and here's why. Because that garbage, that debris that was on the ground, has no purpose. There has been no one who has said, I'm going to make this way. It's going to have an intention. It's going to have a shape. And it is for something. Consider a tennis racket. If I invented the tennis racket, it has a purpose. I have designed the tennis racket. If I give you the tennis racket and you use the tennis racket to start beating people with, I can say to you, what you're doing with the tennis racket is wrong. And I can do that because you are violating the purpose for which the tennis racket was made. But I can't say that with the garbage. I can't say you're doing anything wrong with it because There's no purpose that's being violated with the garbage. When we say you are doing something really wrong, we're saying that there is a purpose that is being violated. And to have a purpose, you have to have a designer. And to have a design, you have to have design. And to have design, you have to have a designer of some kind. We say you ought not do this or you ought to do that because things are designed a certain way. Morality is prescriptive, and it tells us how we ought to behave. It is not just something that describes how we behave. But according to evolution, humans have no purpose. We have no purpose. You are the result of random chance and mutations in an empty, impersonal universe that is going to eventually die in heat death. You have no ultimate purpose. You have no mind behind you that has created you or designed you for anything. So why is it that I ought not hurt you and why I ought to love you? Because I'm not violating any design or I'm not violating any purpose if I do. Number four, useless people. The evolutionary theory of morality allows for the killing of the aged and the sick who do not contribute to our survival but steal resources from those of us who do. You might say, are you kidding me? Well, let me introduce you to someone. This is Peter Singer. Peter Singer has been described in a number of different ways. He's the ethicist, the professor of ethics at Princeton University in New Jersey. Ivy League school, great reputation. He's been known as the most influential philosopher alive today. He's also known as the world's most dangerous man, because his ideas are so influential and they trickle down and his ideas are barbaric. Peter Singer advocates not only abortion and euthanasia, which is the killing of people who either are at a place in life where they have their well-being is eclipsed by their suffering. He also advocates for infanticide, the killing of born babies. Born babies. At one point, his cutoff line was 20 days. If a baby had been born within 20 days, the parents decided that having that child would be too much of a burden and suffering on them because the child has some congenital disease and also the child will have some suffering that they felt that the child didn't need to go through. Peter Singer advocates that they should have the right to be able to put that child to death. And he teaches at Princeton University. He came to Los Angeles this summer, and I had the chance to spend a little bit of time with him. And I asked him the question, by what do you determine whether things are right or wrong? And he said this, well, the greatest good for the greatest number of people should always be done, and we should consider suffering as a major component of that question. I don't like people to suffer, he said. And so if someone is seriously suffering, and they are taking resources away from the greater good of people, and if someone is going to die anyway, then we should have the right, those of us who are bearing the burden of caring for these people, to put them out of their suffering, to euthanize them. Likewise with children, we should be able to take their lives because in the end it will reduce their suffering and it will free up resources because they are useless eaters is the word that he uses. Useless eaters. Well, this is Harriet McBride Johnson. She's a community activist. She's a lawyer. She's also an activist and an outspoken rights advocate for those who are severely disabled. Peter Singer is a very gutsy guy because he invited her to Princeton for a discussion, a public forum on euthanizing, killing people like Harriet McBride Johnson, who are suffering and at some point in her life will not be a contributor to society and will not advance the cause of human race. Now, you would think that in a discussion where someone is an advocate for the rights of people who are in her position and obviously has a sympathetic case because of her position would have won hands down in the debate. But she left saying that Peter Singer's logic was something that was so tight that she couldn't get her head around it and find an answer for. And the reason for it is this. Because she is also an avowed atheist, as is Peter Singer. And whenever Peter Singer would label her arguments as the sanctity of human life or the dignity of persons, she would always say, wait a minute, don't use those terms because those are religious, theistic terms. I am not a theist, I am an atheist, so I reject the term the sanctity of human life. When Peter Singer pushed her and pushed her and pushed her with the logic of his conclusions that says, if you believe that you can abort a baby before it's born, then what's the difference whether you can take its life minutes after it's born? Then why can't you put someone out of its suffering at the end of their life? She realized that the only recourse that she had was to appeal to the fact that she didn't like it because it went against her own preferences and tastes and opinions. She had nothing greater to appeal to than her own moral tastes. This is Jeffrey Dahmer, and he's problem number 5 for the atheistic worldview. Many of you will recognize Dahmer. He, between 1987 and 1991, killed 17 people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. His crimes are so heinous, I can't even tell you all of the things that he did. But he killed 17 men, and believe it or not, the least of which is that he ate parts of them and kept them in his home. He went to prison, and through his father, who had become a Christian later in life, Dahmer eventually became a born-again Christian. You'll hear his testimony here. But what he's going to tell you is that he believed that since there was no one to be ultimately accountable to in the end, because it was just this evolutionary moral sense, that why should he behave the way everyone wanted him to behave? And listen what he has to say.
Blaming other people or other things. So I alone am the one who's responsible for what's happened. Let me ask, when did you first feel that everyone is accountable for their actions? Well, thanks to you for sending creation science material, because I always believe the lie that evolution is truth, the theory of evolution is truth, that we all just came from the slime, and when we died, you know, that was it. There was nothing. So the whole theory cheapens life, and started reading books about how, that show how evolution is just a complete lie. There's no basis in science to uphold it. And I've come to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ is the true creator of the heavens and the earth. It just didn't just happen. And I have accepted him as my Lord and Savior. And I believe that I, as well as everyone else, will be accountable to him.
Growing up, did you feel that you were accountable to your dad or to your mom as the authority?
Yes, I did.
In the house?
Yes, I did. I mean, they didn't let me run wild. They disciplined me. And so I felt accountable to them. But afterwards, after I left the home, that's when I started wanting to sort of create my own little world where I could be the one who had the complete control, where I didn't have to bow to anyone else's demands, and I just took it way too far.
Fine.
At that period of time, I had drifted away from a belief in a supreme being, and I never, as a result, passed along the feeling that we are all accountable in the end. He owns us. And that basic concept is very fundamental to all of us.
You feel that the absence, at least for a while, of a strong religious faith and belief,
for some years,
may have prevented you from instilling some of that in Jeff.
That's right.
Is that how you feel?
Yes, I think I had a big part to do with it. I mean, if a person doesn't think that there is a God to be accountable to, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges?
That's how I thought, anyway. And I've since come to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ is truly God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. They're the only true God.
Jeffrey Dahmer is an extreme case, and I hesitate using him for one reason, because it's very sensational. There is no way would I ever try and say that this is the logical conclusion of denying the existence of God, nor would I ever say that people who don't believe in God cannot be good or don't do good. There are people who do not believe in God who have better moral lives than those of us who do at times. And this is not the necessary logical consequences of denying God. But the point of it is this. It's hard in an evolutionary atheistic framework to show how this would be inconsistent. It's hard to show how it would be inconsistent. It is not necessarily the logical conclusion where everybody must go. Far from that. Far from it to say that everyone who doesn't believe in God should be living and is like Jeffrey Dahmer. But Jeffrey Dahmer's point is at least consistent, that if there is no God, then you should be able to do, or he should do, whatever he wants. Dostoevsky, the Russian writer, put it this way, if there is no God, then everything is permissible. And Friedrich Nietzsche, the brilliant, sort of insane philosopher who was in some ways much ahead of his time, who had realized that Western society had come to the place where they stopped believing in God, and is credited with the statement that God is dead, said this: when one gives up the Christian faith, one pulls the right to Christian morality out from under one's feet. This morality is by no means self-evident. Christianity is a system, a whole view of things, thought out together. And by breaking one main concept of it, the faith in God, it breaks the whole. It stands alone. It stands or falls with faith in God. Christian morality is not necessarily self-evident. We live in a Christian culture, so it seems to be self-evident to us. But Nietzsche's point is correct, I think, that it's not self-evident. And when you give up the belief in God and you try and hold on to Christian morality, you are holding on to a structure that has no foundation. So when atheism wants to talk about bridging the gap between atheism and morality, it makes the argument that it's a Darwinian misfiring that gives you a sense that tells you you should not do this and you should do that. But it says absolutely nothing about true morality. The objective fact that we know that we should do good, that we know that we shouldn't do evil, that weighs down on us and is outside of us. Because conceivably, if we had evolved differently, we would have a radically different morality, according to atheism. And none of us really believe that that's the case, that we could have evolved with a completely backwards morality, where we would think that torture and abuse and cowardness and lying and betraying is a good thing. So it's a bridge to nowhere. So let me close in the next couple minutes just by saying this. What does morality need that evolution can't provide? Well, what's required for morality? Morality requires certainly something in its source that is personal. If there is this law that weighs down on us, that tells us to do the good and avoid the evil, there needs to be some sort of lawgiver. All of the laws that we know of that are prescriptive, that tell us what we ought to do, all come from a personal source. There are physical laws of the universe that are not prescriptive. The laws of physics, the law of gravity, those are just laws that describe the way the universe behaves. But any law that we come into contact with that tells us how we should behave always has a person or a mind behind it. The government says, don't speed. The government says, this is the speed limit. The government says, this is the fine. That's a law that tells us how we ought to behave. There's a mind behind it. The source also needs to be universal, because at all times and places, everyone recognizes a moral obligation. And whatever's behind the moral law that weighs down on us, it needs to be supremely authoritative, because we all recognize we are obligated to submit to morality over and above earthly authorities that conflict with it. So if an inferior is told by Adolf Hitler to do something, Hitler has tremendous authority, and that person should submit to him. But the SS and those in the concentration camps should have said no and submitted to a higher moral authority that was weighing down on them that what they were doing was truly, really wrong. So whatever's behind morality needs to at least be personal, it needs to be timeless and universal, it needs to be supremely authoritative, because even when there are superiors over us who tell us to do things that we know that we shouldn't, we have the obligation to obey the moral law to do the good and avoid the bad. And it needs to be external to humans, because we discover it, we just don't create it. And finally, I mentioned this earlier, morality implies design, because morality comes with an obligation. Obligation implies that there's a purpose. Purpose implies that there's a designer. God is timeless and universal. God is personal. God is all of the things that morality requires for a source and for a foundation to explain why we have this internal, intuitive knowledge of an external, objective moral law. Friedrich Nietzsche, on January 3rd, 1889, had his last day of sanity. No one knows whether he lost his mind because he had syphilis or because he had a brain condition or because he just realized the ultimate logical conclusions of his worldview. It's probably not the latter. But on January 3rd, 1889, in Turin, Italy, he walked into a square and he saw a man just viciously beating the horse that was pulling his carriage. He beat the horse so badly that the horse collapsed to the ground. And Nietzsche ran over and he grabbed the horse and he wept and he wept and he wept as he held that horse. And maybe it's because he saw the consequences of saying that there is no God leaves you no higher standard to appeal to say that you shouldn't treat anyone, even horses, this way. And it's no coincidence that the century after, that on the heels of Nietzsche's declaration that there is no God, has been the bloodiest century, more bloody than all of the others combined before it. Because we have lost an objective moral criterion that weighs down upon us, and we have traded it for immorality that we construct based on our own opinions and our autonomous human reason in our groups and in our communities. And when that happens, we are without any foundation higher than our own personal tastes and feelings to appeal to say what you're doing is truly wrong. Why should I care for you? Why should I love you? Why should I not beat you and abuse you and take you for what I can get? Because you're made in the image and the likeness of God and you have true value and dignity and you shouldn't have your purpose violated by me. But if all you are is a cosmic accident, a random collocation of atoms in a meaningless and absurd universe that came from one pole of nothingness and is going back to another pole of nothingness, why should I give a rip about you? Why should I not just do whatever I can so that I can pass on my genes and so that I can survive because I'm the fittest at your expense? God is the ultimate foundation for morality. Doesn't answer the question of how we know what's right and what's wrong all the time, but it provides a meaningful account for a human experience that we all share, that we know we should do the good and that we should not do the evil. And if you remove him, the consequences are tragic. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this last hour. And what I even realize as I go through it, that there's lots of information and lots of maybe abstract concepts. So I would pray for my friends that they would be encouraged, that there are good arguments in response to people who are militantly against you and your word and belief in you. Even if we can't repeat it back, or even if we can't even remember it 10 minutes after we left. Lord, I pray that we would be able to remember it, and we would be able to be spurred on to think about some of these things and the consequences of ideas as they're played out on the news every night on TV. Thank you that you provide us a foundation and a grounding for good and ultimately evil. Lord, because if you weren't there, as Rachel said this morning, there's not even such a thing as good and evil. There just is what is. Help us to be people who recognize and do the good in a world gone mad in many cases. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thank you.